Welcome, everyone, to week four of the Instructional Framework Development Institute. I'm your host, Justin Bader, and this is our final group session. So we're going to kind of recap what we've done throughout the Institute so far and identify some next steps. And of course, we have some key content today. Very excited to get into that with you and talk about the actual process of developing a leveled rubric and what distinguishes a leveled rubric from frequency rubrics and other kinds of shared criteria that you may have experienced. So in terms of the overall outcomes for this institute, just to briefly review, our goals are first to guide teacher leaders, or specifically one teacher leader that you're working with, in developing one or more team instructional frameworks. And at this stage that we're currently at, if you've been following along week by week, it's not quite fair to call it a team instructional framework yet, because we're working with one individual to kind of pilot the process, to work the kinks out, to figure out what works and what doesn't, and to gain some experience so that when you start to work with a whole team and guide them through this process of developing a team instructional framework, you have some experience, you have some examples, and you have some confidence that you can take them through this. It's not going to be difficult, it's not going to be a problem. And you can kind of win them over because you have that experience of working with one person. Our second objective for the Institute is to begin using the frameworks that you develop, the shared expectations, the rubric language that you develop, to provide more detailed, more specific feedback. And by specific, typically we mean subject specific. There are aspects of practice that matter to certain grade levels, to certain departments or teams within your school, that the overall evaluation criteria that you have in, say, Danielson, don't really allow you to do. They don't really allow you to be that specific. So developing your own framework for that team, that department, that subject is going to allow you to be much more specific in your feedback. Our third objective is to make sure that we're gaining an insider's view of practice. If we're looking at one specific practice, we don't want to look at that practice as outsiders, as people who don't really get into the weeds of teaching and learning, and we just kind of keep it at arm's length, and we just say, you know, can I see it? Is it visible to me? We don't want to have that outsider's perspective when it comes to understanding teacher practice. We really want to gain the insider's view and think about the decisions the teacher is making from the teacher's perspective based on the information available to the teacher. So we will get into that a bit more today. And of course, as always, any shared expectations that we're creating, we're developing with the teacher so that they are shared and we're validating those. So we're not just talking with the teacher and then doing our own thing. It is a collaborative process, even though we're only working with one person at this stage. We want to gain experience in making this a collaborative process. And this may be the first set of shared expectations that your teachers have actually had input on, right? Like if you use the Danielson framework for teacher evaluation, your teachers probably did not have much input on the Danielson framework, but here we are, and you're going to see just how powerful it is to have these team instructional frameworks today. And we're going to get into some specific examples here in session four. So in terms of our agenda for today, I thought we would start by briefly recapping the action steps from the past three sessions. And of course, you can go back and watch those sessions at any time in your member dashboard. And I highly encourage you to do that and to take those actions week by week whenever you start this process. We'll talk about how to finalize your rubric. And hopefully you got an idea based on your week three actions of what needs to be covered in that rubric. This week, we're going to talk about actually writing that and actually dividing that set of expectations into key components and levels of performance. And we'll talk about how to make sure that your levels of performance are not inflated, and how to make sure that we're not simply flattering one teacher on the team by saying that their practice is level four, you know, and then nothing else exists in the world, right? We'll talk about calibrating those levels of performance. We'll talk about validating the insider's view of the practice. And then finally, we'll talk about taking the next step, going beyond working with one individual and actually engaging the whole teacher team in developing a team instructional framework. All right, so let's recap our week-by-week action steps. For week one, we said the first step is really to find the right person, somebody who can go through this process with you and be a trusted partner, be someone who will engage wholeheartedly in this process, not be resistant, not be so overwhelmed by other stuff that they're doing that they don't have time, but really, you know, a good thought partner who is a practicing teacher in the department that you have chosen to work with. And I would, of course, much rather choose the right person than a certain department. So if you haven't picked someone yet, you probably have someone in mind who would be a great thought partner, a great teacher to work with on this. And in week one, we said, you know, just secure that initial commitment from them. And if you can, as kind of extra credit, go ahead and actually observe in their classroom, try to see that practice that you want to focus on, and then talk with them about what you saw. If you didn't get to do that in week one, of course, you could wrap up some of that in week two. Again, confirming the commitment, finalizing the focus on the practice, and actually observing that practice. So in week two, I asked you to actually talk with the teacher about what practice, and then go see that practice in the teacher's classroom, and then finalize your decision. You know, do we want to continue with this focus, or did our observation lead us to something else that would be more fruitful? And if you did pivot after week two, totally fine. Do something that feels valuable to you, that feels valuable to the teacher, because this is not meant to be an academic exercise. You know, we're in schools, of course, but this is meant to be a practical exercise that results in a tangible asset that you can use as an instructional leader in the form of a rubric. And again, I'll give you specific examples today. In week three, we talked about observability bias and how there's a tendency when we go into a classroom to look for something specific, we tend to look as observers. We tend to think in terms of our needs. You know, it's like if you're a journalist and you're writing a story, but you're trying to cover a specific angle of that story, and it's not really about what the people's concerns, you know, the person that you're talking to right that moment. It feels like it's an outside agenda. We've got to get away from that outside agenda because it causes us to ignore what the teacher is actually thinking about and the decisions that they're making. So we've got to get that insider's view. We also talked about establishing context and specificity, and taking the step of outlining those key components of that practice. And we plotted those on the iceberg graph, if you'll remember, with visibility on the vertical axis and the time span or the zoom level on the horizontal axis. So we want to make sure that we can actually get a sense of the visibility and zoom for those key components, and then actually start drafting that rubric. So again, the practice of drafting a rubric has just five steps, and these are all laid out very nicely for you and for teachers in the teacher-facing program, the Instructional Framework Development Program. So some of what you'll see today is covered in that teacher-facing program, and I do recommend that you go through that before you ask teachers to go through it. But the process is simply this, and we've been talking about these steps working with one teacher, but this is the process that we'll ultimately have everyone go through. So select a practice, something that's high leverage, high frequency, high variability. Draft a list of key characteristics, not step one, step two. You know, teachers already know the steps, but we're talking about the real substantive characteristics of using that practice well. Plot those practices on, or those characteristics on, the evidence of practice grid. And then for each characteristic, develop a rubric with four levels of performance. And then finally, use that in feedback conversations, talk with the teacher about the rubric, what changes need to be made, and then revise it. And of course, we've got a whole workbook to guide you through that, to guide teachers through that process. And certainly, this is a process that does not require administrative involvement. So if you have teachers who are ready to roll with this, hand it over to them. Send them the link. We've got a link that you can send directly to teachers. If you go to dashboard.principalcenter.com/institute, you will see a link to the full Instructional Framework Development Program. It's just on one page. They don't need to log in. Just send them that link and they can run with it. So if you have someone in mind that you think, okay, this team, really, I can send them the link and they're going to do amazing things with this, feel free to do that. I didn't want you to go ahead and send that out before going through this program, before going through the Institute, where we're talking from the admin side about the, you know, the rollout process and really understanding it as a leader. Because I think we've got to make sure that we're doing this in a thoughtful way, and we've got to help the right people go first. But when you're ready, if you have someone who is ready to go with this, feel free to just send them that link. All right, so let's talk about the rubric. We want our outcome from this entire process to be the development of a rubric that we can use in feedback conversations. And I have to say, when I use the term rubric, I have to be a little bit cautious because rubrics can feel like a rating tool. And what I don't want to happen is for someone to have a rubric and then they repeatedly get scored on that rubric, You know, every time an administrator comes in, that rubric that they developed gets pulled out and boom, you're a 2 today, boom, you're a 3 today. That's not the purpose of these rubrics. The purpose of these rubrics is to align evidence of practice with shared expectations and say, what did we see today and how does that line up with our rubric? It is not typically appropriate to score what we're seeing using that rubric based on one observation, because the practice is something that is used over the course of the year, right? And we're not talking about, this is not like a skateboarding performance where, you know, you watch the competitor perform one time and then you score them and then you're done. That's not what this is about, and that's not what this is for. This is for conversation and growth. It's for feedback conversations where we calibrate the evidence of practice against our shared expectations. And ultimately, will you evaluate every teacher if you're an administrator? Yes, but that is not what this is for. This is for talking about practice. So when I say rubric, just keep that in mind. We are not talking about scoring. We are not talking about evaluation. We're talking about supporting growth through an evidence-based feedback conversation. Make sense? Okay, so let's talk about what those rubrics need to look like. There are good and bad rubrics, and you've probably seen some bad rubrics. Often, we don't have enough specificity in our rubrics. And I have this slide is from the Instructional Framework Development Program, the teacher-facing version. And in that program, you will see that we talk about four levels of specificity. Sometimes we say, you know what, I want you to use more formative assessment. And that's all we say. We're not specific about what performative assessment looks like, what the components of it are. We just give the name. So that's kind of the most surface level of specificity here in this little chart in the bottom left-hand corner here. Just simply saying the name of the practice, or it might even be a buzzword, or, you know, teachers might say, oh, you're really on a kick about formative assessment. If that's as specific as we are, people will know that you want to see more formative assessment, but that won't really be actionable for them. They won't really know what they're supposed to do with that. So the next level of specificity is to have some sort of checklist and to say, well, when I see formative assessment, it should look like this, this, and this. And often checklists take the form of steps that, you know, that don't really capture the heart of what the practice is about, and teachers kind of know the steps. So we want to be more specific and actually have a rubric, not just a, did you do this, did you do that, checklist. But a lot of rubrics are what I call frequency rubrics. And this is true for teacher evaluation rubrics. It's true for fidelity of implementation rubrics that come with some programs. Like if you look at Responsive Classroom, they have great rubrics for assessing program implementation for their social and emotional learning program for elementary schools. Some of their rubrics are frequency rubrics that describe the consistency or, you know, how often the teacher uses the practice. And some of them are true qualitatively leveled rubrics. You have to kind of look and see what the focus of that rubric is. But this is an example of a frequency rubric for formative assessment. And if you look at this, you can see why it's not especially useful. So this is a frequency rubric. Look at level 1, level 2, level 3, and level 4. Level 1 is never uses formative assessment, and level 4 is always uses formative assessment, and levels 2 and 3 are just kind of in the middle in terms of frequency, sometimes or frequently. And the challenge in effectively using a frequency rubric is that it doesn't really tell the teacher what to do differently, it just tells the teacher what to do more of. You know, more often you should use formative assessment. You're not using formative assessment enough. And enough doesn't really get at the heart of the instructional decisions that teachers are making. It doesn't get at the instructional situation that teachers are using the practice to address. So if you've ever developed a rubric and you felt like, you know what, this really isn't all that helpful. Why are we doing this rubric thing? A big part of the problem may be that it is a frequency rubric and it doesn't really describe much of a substantive difference between the levels of performance. And it kind of misses the heart of the practice. So this is an example of a qualitatively leveled rubric. And if you use Danielson, you will recognize this as 1F, designing student assessments. And I'm not going to read the entire slide here, but this is from Charlotte Danielson's domain 1 on, you know, kind of planning and preparation. Level 1 in this particular component on designing assessments says assessment procedures are not congruent with instructional outcomes and lack criteria by which student performance will be assessed. The teacher has no plan to incorporate formative assessment in the lesson or unit. So even just looking at level one, if a teacher is not using formative assessment, rather than just say to the teacher, hey, you should use formative assessment, and hope they know what that means, look how much more helpful this rubric is. Even the level one description tells the teacher, okay, my assessment procedures should be congruent with my instructional outcomes and should have criteria by which student performance will be assessed. I should have a plan to incorporate formative assessment into the lesson or unit. So even the level one description paints a roadmap for the teacher, paints a path for them to move forward. It paves that pathway for them. Let's look at level two. You see the word partially congruent. Assessment criteria have been developed, but they're not clear. So we're starting to see some differences here. And it's not just that the teacher went from not doing it to doing these formative assessment things. There are actual descriptions that you can align with your evidence of practice. The teacher's approach to using formative assessment is rudimentary, including only some of the instructional outcomes. All right, so we see a clear qualitative difference here. Level three, which is satisfactory, all the instructional outcomes may be assessed by the proposed assessment plan. Assessment methodologies have been adapted for groups of students. Criteria and standards are clear. Well-developed strategy. Teacher has designed particular approaches to be used, and so on. And then level four adds well-designed and includes students as well as the teacher in users of the assessment information. So as you can see here, this is not just about frequency. This is not just about how often do you use formative assessment. We're really describing what formative assessment is and how it can be used effectively in the rubric. And in our team instructional frameworks, our TIFFs, we can actually be more specific because we're not even describing the subcomponents of student assessments here in the Danielson framework. But we can actually get into the subcomponents of assessment, whether it's formative assessment and the purpose we're using it for, and then break that into the subcomponents when we're working with specific teacher teams. So imagine how powerful that is to have that specificity. All right, part of that specificity is the subcomponents. You know, what are the elements of assessment, but another part of it is the levels of performance. So that's why we have a rubric, a grid. We have the components in rows, and we have the levels of performance in columns, typically in a rubric. And level one is what I would describe as the apprenticeship of observation, you know, kind of how we were taught as students, what we experienced when we were kids going through school. And it's, you know, it's recognizable to parents as just fine, normal practice. But as educators who have been trained more recently than we were, you know, kids, you know, we've obtained professional training, teacher education and graduate education and so forth, we know we can do better than that. And we would never advise teachers to revert to that level of a very, very basic practice. And I think Danielson calls, I would say if we're looking at a teacher evaluation rubric like Danielson, sometimes that very basic level of how we were taught as kids is kind of a level two on Danielson, and level one is really just not doing it at all. But I would describe, I think in our team instructional frameworks, we need to have level one as that apprenticeship of observation, you know, just the basics of how we were taught when we were kids with no improvement whatsoever. Level two is when people are starting to be intentional, right? They're committing to the area of practice. You know, they're using formative assessment. They're at least trying to incorporate formative assessment, for example. But it's kind of rough, right? They're just going through the motions. They're, you know, it's kind of like when a kid first learns to walk, there's a lot of wobbling and a lot of falling down, and they're making an effort. They're taking some action, but they're really not proficient yet. And level three is what I describe as true proficiency, the local best of that practice. And on every team in your school, you probably have a mixture of people who are at that kind of wobbly level two stage where they're, okay, they're trying to use formative assessment, but it's not really having the results yet. It might feel like a waste of time to the teacher, just like to a kid who's just learning to walk. They might say, forget this, I'm just gonna go back to crawling. I'm a lot faster at that. And you know, if they're trying to get from point A to point B, they're not gonna walk, they're gonna crawl because it's faster. That's where a lot of teachers are going to be whenever you start developing shared expectations for a specific practice. But you are going to have a shining star. You are going to have someone who is your local best and who is the strongest example present in your school. Or if perhaps this is a completely new practice, it may be an example that you're looking at from another nearby school, but something you can actually go and see. Maybe you have video of this practice being used, or maybe you have trainers who came and modeled for you when you adopted the new approach. But this is the best you've seen and what you aspire to. So like if teachers are hitting level 3, you will be very happy. You will be thrilled that they have reached that level of proficiency, and that's all that's required. Level 4 is far beyond that, though. Level 4 is what I call the professional model. This is not just the best you've seen in your school, but the best practice you have ever heard of. You know, if there is some legendary teacher who's been doing this forever and really was a pioneer and really just is at the top of his or her game, that's your level 4 professional model. What I want to encourage you not to do with level 4 is to just take the best teacher on the team and say, okay, well, whatever you're doing, that's level 4. I believe when we do that, we rob teachers of the opportunity to grow beyond level 3. If you have someone who is great, if they're just a wonderful teacher, that's fine. They are wonderful. I worked with many wonderful teachers. But I think it would be pretty arrogant of us to say that just like the best person on the team is the best person in the profession. Of all the millions of teachers around the world, this one person on the team who's working with me is the best there ever was, the best that exists anywhere in the world. I think there's an arrogance to that that we need to avoid. So the best example that you have within your school of the practice really should be level 3, not level 4. You might not really be able to imagine level 4. And if so, that's okay. It's fine to leave it blank and allow teachers to later articulate what level 4 might look like as they figure out, you know, what are the full strengths and weaknesses of level 3? Is there something that we could push to that's beyond that, that would address those weaknesses and push those strengths even farther? But don't make the mistake, my friends, of saying that your best teacher in your school or the teacher that you're working with right now is level 4. We want to have a vision that stretches everyone, that goes far beyond what we're able to do locally. And I think the Lucretius underestimation is an interesting concept here. Dr. Amy Bader brought this to my attention from a book that she was reading, and she's used this example in a lot of her project-based learning trainings that she does. She says, Lucretius said, a little river seems to him who has never seen a larger river to be a mighty stream. And so with other things, a tree, a man, anything appears greatest to him that never knew a greater. And when it comes to developing our rubrics and calibrating those 4 levels of performance, it is very tempting to say that, well, my favorite teacher is a level 4. But I assure you, with the millions of people in our profession, there is an even better model out there. And I want to encourage you to hunt for that practice and figure out what it looks like and make that your model so that even the greatest teacher, even the mightiest stream in your school has an opportunity to grow. Don't rob teachers of that opportunity to grow toward a higher vision. And that higher vision is, of course, level 4 in our rubric. What I thought it would be helpful to do now is to share a couple of examples of leveled rubrics that have been developed by people who've been through our High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification Program, which is included with our Navigator membership, which is included with our Instructional Leadership Directors Roundtable membership. So if you've not been through that program, you should find that in your dashboard. And if you're interested in purchasing this program for your team, feel free to reach out and we can figure out how to make that happen. But this is from Peg Foster. And Peg is, I believe, an instructional coach in Hershey, Pennsylvania, and she focused on, I'm just going to share a part of what she developed around using appropriate instructional groupings. Now, it would be tempting as an instructional leader who realizes that you have an opportunity to help your teachers be more effective with using instructional groupings to just say to everybody, hey, everybody, I want you to be more thoughtful and more intentional about using instructional groupings that are appropriate for the activity. Okay? So do that more, right? And you probably could get some benefit from just telling everybody, hey, use appropriate instructional groupings more. I'm going to be looking for that. Make sure you're using instructional groupings that are appropriate. But we know now that if we develop a rubric that has specific subcomponents of what it means to use appropriate instructional groupings, that specificity is going to be extremely helpful to teachers, and the specificity of having a leveled rubric with different levels of performance is going to give them a roadmap for growth in each of those subcomponents. And I'm just going to share two of Peg's components with you today. And this was part of her work in earning the High Performance Instructional Leadership Certification, which you are welcome to earn too by submitting the portfolio that you can find at dashboard.principalcenter.com/certification. If you'd like more information on that, you can download our portfolio packet and start going through that course. But Peg focused on several elements. The two I'm going to share with you today are B, the grouping method is purposeful, and C, groupings are based on assessment data. Okay, so let's look at what Peg developed. For B, the grouping method is purposeful, heterogeneous, differentiated, leveled, etc. Peg identified three levels of performance, and it's totally fine that she did not specify level four. If you're not blown away by something to put in level four, if you haven't come across a professional model, leave level four blank by all means. So level one, Peg said, students are not grouped purposefully and work in whatever groupings they choose or were already in prior to the learning activity. All right, so this is kind of unsatisfactory basic approach, but again, we're not here to score this. We're here to have a conversation with the teacher and align our evidence of practice with these shared expectations. Okay, so if I see kids are sitting with their friends and there's not any particular reason for that, that would be level one here. And as a result, students miss out on much of their opportunity for learning. Level two, students work in purposeful but problematic groupings, missing opportunities for learning due to the composition of their group. And remember, level two here is the kind of wobbly start, right? Like the baby is not crawling, they're standing up and trying to walk, but it's kind of shaky. It's not really proficient yet, but at least the person is taking action. They're making some progress. Level three is where we really start to see proficiency, where the kid is really walking and it's faster than crawling, and it's probably going to stick when we get to level three. Peg says, students are grouped according to the teacher's instructional purpose, resulting in ideal levels of engagement and support. The teacher changes the grouping structure as needed to match the instructional purpose and students' needs. And that's really what we want, right? Like, we want our students to be grouped in a way that matches whatever's going on in class, that matches the instructional purpose, that results in ideal levels of engagement and support. And off the top of my head, I don't know what's beyond that. Peg didn't specify, but over time, we might get some ideas. And a great way to use these rubrics is to further refine your vision. And if you see something that really captures the essence of that professional model, like what that next level would be, jot it down and start using it. So I hope you can see those four levels of performance here. Level one, apprenticeship of observation. Two, taking action. Three, the local best. And four, the professional model, the best we've ever heard of. And again, we left that blank. In component C that Peg developed for grouping students, she said C is grouping based on assessment data. Groupings are based on assessment data. And she actually does have four levels for this one. So let's look at Peg's four levels of performance here. Level one, assessment is not used to determine instructional groupings. Students aren't aware of the criteria. They don't receive feedback on how to improve. Level two, assessment with a single measure is used for the teacher to make those decisions. Students receive feedback later. Level three, assessment with multiple measures and data points is used for the teacher and students to determine instructional groupings. So now we're starting to get some student ownership over those grouping decisions based on that assessment data, which has multiple sources. Students receive feedback and are aware of the criteria. And then level four builds on that further. Multiple data points reviewed and analyzed with students to determine groupings. Students self-monitor progress, and student-teacher conferences are used to evaluate their progress. So we got even further into assessment there, not just about the groupings, but really deep into assessment and how it can be used. So that is just part of Peg's rubric for student groupings. The specificity there really is the point. If someone does not know how to be more effective with instructional groupings, now they do. If they have this rubric in front of them, they know exactly what to do. I'd like to share another example now from Heather Bell Williams, who you've seen make an appearance in this program so far. Heather is an elementary principal in New Brunswick, Canada, and she was developing a rubric for her HPILC portfolio on using balanced literacy. And their balanced literacy system has 9 components that need to occur for balanced literacy to be balanced. You know, these are the essential components. And she was developing a rubric. This is a draft that she developed and specified, you know, that one of the key components of balanced literacy is planning and scheduling the 9 components. So if you don't actually schedule the 9 components into your day as an elementary teacher, it's not really going to be balanced, right? You're not going to include those 9 components in any kind of balanced way. So she zoomed in on scheduling. And by the way, a great way to do this, to think about, okay, what are the key components here, is to compare teachers and to say, okay, this person is really rocking it. It's really working well in this classroom. This other person is just struggling. It's shaky. They're inconsistent. They don't really know what they're doing. They come to me with a lot of questions and confusion and they just don't get it. Break it down into the components by looking at those differences. And one of the differences Heather saw was this teacher over here who's got it down pat. One of the things she's got down pat is she schedules the time, right? It's not just, oh, hopefully we'll get to it. It's intentional. So here's the rubric Heather developed for scheduling. Level 1, there's no evidence of a schedule or attempts at a schedule have failed to result in implementation of all 9 components on some sort of routine basis. Level 2, there is a schedule that includes all 9 components. Some weeks it's followed and some weeks certain elements are postponed or condensed and it's not really followed with fidelity. So that's kind of that shaky level of, okay, we're doing it, we're taking action, we're trying, but we're not there yet. Level 3, proficient. The teacher creates a schedule for every week that includes all 9 components, not just bi-weekly, but every week, and integrates those into other subject areas. That can often help with a lot of the time issue. If people say, well, I don't really have time to do all 9 of them, maybe part of the difference between this teacher who's proficient with this and this other teacher who's really struggling is the lack of integration in the struggling teacher's classroom. The 9 components really need to be integrated for this to work. Heather is capturing perfectly here what it is that makes this practice actually work so that there's a roadmap to move that teacher from unsuccessful to successful and proficient. The schedule is followed consistently and the teacher uses the needs assessment to find areas where he or she can improve. And then level 4, this is the professional model here. Teacher creates and diligently and consistently follows a schedule that includes all 9 components as well as integration into other areas. The teacher seeks to support other teachers in implementation of a balanced literacy approach and actively seeks the help of a literacy mentor in order to constantly improve. Now, Heather is taking some cues from the Danielson framework here in noting that level 4 is really about going above and beyond and involving students, in this case, it would be working with colleagues that, you know, you're not required to work with on this particular thing, but really taking on a leadership role. There's usually some sort of next level leadership component to level 4. And notice that she's pushing the teacher in level 4 to seek outside expertise. You know, if you have a mentor, if you have an author that you follow, if you have an expert, a trainer, a consultant, maybe a master teacher that you've worked with, someone that you can look to continue to push you forward once you're already proficient. That, my friends, is where this can go. So, to recap the process here, now that you have a couple of examples, I want to encourage you to actually do this. Give this a try. It is not as hard as you might have been thinking. These were developed fairly quickly by our HPILC participants, Peg and Heather. Work with one person. You can, you know, and I think they didn't even have this whole process to go through of working with one teacher on one practice, identifying the key components and developing a 4-leveled rubric for those key components. You can do this. And now, my friends, is the time. Go for it. Then, once you've drafted your rubric, it's time to validate that rubric with the teacher that you have been working with. Use it again to observe the same practice and see if it's generalizable. See if the rubric was big picture enough that it didn't just capture the dimensions of practice for that practice in that specific lesson. If you use that practice in a different lesson, the rubric should still fit. So give it a try and see if it still works. And remember, if you're thinking, well, I don't know the next time the teacher's going to be using that practice, Well, then that's a good sign that we didn't focus on something that was high frequency, high leverage, or high variability enough. Like, this should be something that people are doing frequently, not constantly necessarily, not every single day, but, you know, probably a couple times a week, this should be relevant. And if it's not, we need to find something that's more relevant, that's going to have a higher impact for us. Then you want to discuss that rubric and what that allows you to discuss in terms of the evidence of the teacher's practice. Did we really get it right? Did we capture the heart of the practice? Did we capture the insider's view? And we want to look at three things when we're talking about the insider's view with the teacher. So we're using the rubric to discuss what we saw in the lesson, or to discuss what we saw of the practice. And we want to make sure that it correctly describes and fits with the instructional situation, you know, what was going on in the classroom that prompted the use of that particular teacher practice. Did it fit? And did we anticipate that this was the kind of instructional situation in which this practice would be used? Or is it really something else? Maybe we need to pivot. Did it describe and frame up the teacher's instructional decisions correctly? Did it capture that internal thought process that the teacher was going through as they were using that practice? Or did we suffer from observability bias? Did we reduce what the teacher was doing in their head to something that's simpler and kind of misses the point because it's observable to us? Or did we really get it right? And then third, are those truly the key components? Did we capture the right dimensions of that practice, or do we need to revise them? And then, of course, we've got our four levels of performance. We want to make sure that we're calibrated on those. Did we truly describe our local best and either leave room for a professional model that we'll identify in the future? Or if we do know what to put there, did we describe something that truly is growth, that is ambitious even for our very best teacher? So give that a try. Here are your week four action steps for our final group session here in the Instructional Framework Development Institute. First, work with the teacher to draft that rubric with at least three levels of performance for each component in the practice. It's okay if you don't have level four yet, but use that rubric with the teacher. Observe again, talk about the evidence of practice that you gathered, align that with the rubric and see if it fits, and see if you can figure out what should start to go in level four. As you observe more, you can start to get a hint of that, but it may take a while, so it's okay to leave level four blank for now. Use that rubric over and over again in observations with that one teacher. Revise it until you feel good about it, and then when you're ready, share it with the team and say, hey, I've been working with so-and-so on this, would really love to have your input. We've been drafting some of the key elements of what this practice looks like and what decisions you're making and how you're using that practice in a specific situation within your class. And I want to make sure that we've captured the key dimensions of that. So I'd love to be able to use this with you and get your feedback so that we can revise it and truly make it a team instructional framework. So that is where we are headed with this. And that brings us to the end of our group trainings here. What I would like to invite you to do when you reach this point, when you're about to share it with the team, you feel good about it, or if you don't quite get that far and you just like some feedback and some input from me, please reach out and we can set up a call. I would be happy to review whatever you have and consult with you on that framework and get you going in the right direction toward that ultimate team instructional framework. Now, if you have just been going through this training and not really doing any of this week by week, if you've just been kind of previewing it and you're going to go back and get started later, what I want to encourage you to do is to, of course, review these four trainings, review the full teacher-facing instructional framework development program that we have in your dashboard. And again, there's a link that you can simply send to teachers. They don't need to log in. And a lot of what is covered in that you've heard about from this program, but I encourage you to preview the instructional framework development program before you have teachers go through it, so you know exactly what we're asking teachers to do there. And start recruiting more people, right? Start talking with people who you think would also be a good fit to go through this. If you haven't identified someone yet, get a couple candidates in mind, go talk to them, feel them out, see how they feel about it, and get started. And as you get started and as you start to select a topic, a specific practice to focus on, start taking notes when you identify differences between teachers. When you see that one person is really a superstar with this particular practice. And this other person is kind of like the toddler who's trying to walk. Like they're doing it, they're taking action, but it's really kind of shaky and they're not there yet. Take notes on those differences. This is what Heather Bell Williams did as she was developing her rubrics, and she has quite a few now. She would just notice the difference between what teachers were doing. If somebody's doing something that's not working, jot some notes down about that. You don't even have to share them with the teacher until further down the road. But describe what you're seeing that's not working, and describe what you're seeing that is working, and compare. And that can get you going. That, my friends, brings us to the end of our live trainings for the Instructional Framework Development Institute. Again, review all of this at your convenience. Go through the Instructional Framework Development Program. Reach out. Talk with teachers. Bring other people on board and get started with this. And when you do, you will start to see the benefits of that specificity. When you have shared expectations, your feedback conversations can be so much more powerful because you are giving people a roadmap, not just saying, hey, I want you to do more formative assessment, but you're actually giving people a roadmap for what that looks like and how to get better. Thanks so much for being a part of the Institute. I'm Justin Bader. Please feel free to reach out at any time if I can be of service. Take care.